everybody. Welcome to hour number one of the Saturday special. We got a couple of interesting folks in the studio here to converse with you today on the, the 27th of October in the year of our Lord, 2007. Stay tuned with us. We're going to have a pretty fun program.
Good morning. Now stay right here on KSCO Radio.
Okay, this is a heads up for all of you who are interested in Santa Cruz. We will have two of the longest standing, most powerful people in Santa Cruz as guests on the next Saturday special. Councilman and many times Mayor Mike Rotkin and City Redevelopment Czar Seal Cirillo are going to be right here on your favorite radio station to talk with you live about jobs, traffic, growth management, university relations, convention centers, the homeless, drugs, keeping Santa Cruz weird, whatever and wherever the discussion takes us. So, here's your chance to question and make comments directly to people who can and do make things happen on the next KSCO special, this Saturday, 10 a.m. to 12 noon, right here on All We Ever Wanted to Do Was Be a Vehicle for Productive Civil Discussion Radio, AM 1080 KSCO. You know what? Now, that's not as appropriate an opening theme as this is. There. A special fanfare. All right. First one is the one that we use when we anticipate, you know, a Jerry Springer type program. Nah, none of that.
No throwing chairs in the studio today.
We've sort of outgrown that, you know, around here. I mean, I used to think it was sort of cool to have that kind of radio, but after a while, I realized that when people are yelling and screaming at each other, no one gets anything out of it, you know, because everybody's stepping on everybody else. And there's no reason to do that anyhow. We want to have a nice civil discussion about where we've been, where we're going here around this town. And before we get too far into it, I need to apologize to Seal Cirillo, because when I called her and sort of had to finesse her into agreeing to come on the radio here, I had told her that we were going to be talking primarily about the relationship between the university and the city of Santa Cruz. And that was spurred by an article that I had read in a local weekly newspaper recently, where Seal, who is the head of the redevelopment agency in Santa Cruz for, 25 years now?
The earthquake was 18 years this past October 17th, and I joined the city 3 months after that.
October. Still a wonderful long tenure here, but for some reason I thought that you were you associated with the city in some way before you became redevelopment director?
No, I had only been to Santa Cruz once in my life before the earthquake and before I joined.
And how did that happen?
To ride the big dipper.
Yeah, I mean, how did that happen?
My one visit was to check it out. In 1989, and at that time, when I visited, I was a little concerned about the conditions that existed in the community. It didn't seem to be a thriving community.
Yeah,
and
it a prosperity, or someone called it a prosperity-free zone, and I thought.
that name sort of stuck with me. Now, Mike, you had already been on the city council, I think, for what, 10 years or something when Seals showed up, right?
Actually, I'd been on the council previously for 10 years. I was on the council between 79 and 88, and then I was off when the earthquake happened, and I didn't get back on the council. We have a two-term consecutive limit, so I served two terms. I was off for 4 years, and I came back right after the earthquake in 92, and frankly, came back. I had never planned on just, you know, being a candidate for life or something, which seems to have turned out here. But after the earthquake, I really had a sense that the city needed somebody who had some idea of how things actually work to try it. Because we were, I mean, that was a very, very serious crisis for us.
Oh, and big time.
And so I felt, you know, it was something I could actually had something to contribute to at that point.
Well, let's back up a little bit to your days of arriving in Santa Cruz, I believe, as a university lecturer. Am I right?
No, actually, I came here for a summer job in 1969, worked doing research on migrant workers with Bill Friedland, who I knew from Cornell University. And I had intended to go back to New York, but I was in Santa Cruz about 2 days and thought, I'm not leaving this place. This is amazing. Just as, aside from not wanting to go back to 20 below zero winters in upstate New York, I really very, very quickly fell in love with Santa Cruz and decided I wanted to find a way to stay here. And after my job ran out at the end, it was a summer job, and when it ran out, I looked for work as a motorcycle mechanic, which I had done before, and couldn't find work. I looked for just odd construction jobs.
This was
jobs.
In the late 70s?
Just
or the
69.
I'm sorry.
1969.
Wow.
And then what happened, it was just an accident, really. I had applied to graduate schools in English literature back at Cornell when I was at Cornell and got admitted to a bunch of places and then decided not to go to graduate school. But after I looked for other jobs in Santa Cruz, I heard there was an opening in the History of Consciousness graduate program here because someone didn't show up who was intending to come. And I had a Woodrow Wilson fellowship for 4 years, which was very impressive, I think, to them. And they asked me if I wanted that open spot. So I said, sure. And I ended up in graduate school. I had never planned to be a college teacher. And then I was a teaching assistant for 4 years, and eventually a job opened up at the university, and I applied for that job and took it. So that started.
But now,
that
was, now History of Consciousness, isn't that was Community Studies was Professor Friedland, who's
right
and who's
MIT
still living in Santa Cruz, right?
Yes, he's retired from the university, but he still comes to work every day at the university and does research on actually on wine industry and impacts on labor and things like that. And he's one of the, you know, it's great to see him. He gets there about 8:30 in the morning, and the rest of everybody else wanders in later and stuff. He's busy working early in the morning. But so anyway, the teaching assistantships I had were in community studies. That was my link to eventually a teaching job in that department. But the graduate program I was in was this interdisciplinary, pretty unique graduate program called History of Consciousness at UCSC.
Okay, and so what is it that got you interested in local politics, and when was that?
Well, I had no, you know, in terms of electoral politics, no interest. If you had told me I was going to run for city council even a year before I did, and that was 1979, I would have laughed in your face. And I was doing organizing work on the west side of Santa Cruz around healthcare issues and just neighborhood concerns about traffic and things that neighborhoods usually get very excited about, and I was very involved in those issues, but mainly healthcare. And we were trying to get a health center on the west side. And in 1979, people suggested that we run a protest campaign to let the people down at City Hall know they were voters on the west side. They weren't taking our health center issues seriously. They had closed the Garfield Park Branch Library, little neighborhood library,
right,
and
that.
We got involved in a struggle and got it reopened, and that was, you know, felt really exciting that you could actually make a difference in people's lives, because that was a great place for seniors and
now,
kids.
Now, if this was circa night, you know, I have an iPhone, and it's ringing. Yeah.
That's the ring.
That's the ring, the barking dog.
Somebody's barking at you there, Michael.
Yeah. So, here, now how do I turn this thing off? I mean, it's so new, I don't know how to turn it off. So, here, I'm just going to turn it off here. Let's just do that here. All right. So
good sound effects.
No, that's impressive.
Listen, you know, they're not a sponsor, but I fell in love with this thing. You know, I buy just about every new a smartphone when they come out, because it's supposed to be able to, you know, you're supposed to be able to check email.
Organize your life, yeah.
I get a lot of emails that have media files, like, you know, television, I mean video and audio files.
Right.
And every one of them, up until now, they say you can do it. There's a way you can do it, but well, how do you do it? Well, that's what we have, the 30-day exchange policy, you know, return. But you go figure it out for 30 days, and if you can't figure it out, bring it back. We'll give you your money back. And, of course, I'm so busy that I can't. I don't figure it out, and the 30 days passes, and I'm stuck with the damn thing that I never use. But this iPhone now is something that...
It actually seems to be working. It
works amazing. It's just great. Just great. So anyhow...
Evidently, that wasn't an important call.
We'll find out later, I'm sure.
Yeah, we will, actually. So, anyhow, where were we here? Oh, so politics.
So basically, I ran a protest campaign in 1979.
But it wasn't new then, because it was 5 years earlier. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mike. Didn't everybody in Santa Cruz get a dose of what political activism could do with a lighthouse field thing that was spearheaded by Gary Patton?
The big wake-up call there was the election of 1973 when a slate of Bert Muley, Sally DiGirolamo, and Virginia Sharp swept the election. There were three seats open, and they ran mainly as environmentalists, which was new to Santa Cruz at the time. And they swept into office. They never were a majority, but, you know, it was a shock to the old guard in Santa Cruz that these people who thought that preserving Lighthouse Field as an open space and not building a large development there made sense. And they also were, the same group was against development on the North Coast, which had been a long-time plan for a city of about 10,000 on the North Coast.
Yeah.
There had been a plan to double-deck Mission Street as a way of increasing traffic, an eight-lane ocean. This is the whole plan that was sort of coming into fruition. An eight-lane Ocean Street coming into town, it's Chestnut Street, a little neighborhood street now, into a six-lane return loop from the beach. And two 12-story towers on Frederick Street, where the Frederick Street Irregulars that Sally DiGirolamo came out of got organized. And all this stuff was coming down and, you know, on its way to Santa Cruz in 1973-74. And that, plus primarily the Lighthouse Field issue, launched not only Gary Patton, which people I'm sure know about at the county level, but at the city level, was the beginning sort of warning that progressive politics, something different than had been going on, was on the way.
Yeah.
And I worked on that campaign, but, you know, I was interested in Lighthouse Field because I live, four houses from Lighthouse Field. It was
right.
A neighborhood issue to me rather than some broad change in city politics. And so when I ran this protest campaign in 79, I said, well, you know, I believe in democratic socialism and feminism, and I'm not going to duck. I'm not going to hide what my politics are from people, so I'm not electable. This is a conservative town, which it was at the time.
In 79? Nah. It had changed by then.
No, you look at
69, yes.
Look at the majority.
You got here, absolutely.
The majority of the Santa Cruz City Council was four conservative Republicans, you know, the year before I ran. This town, we still had at that time, we had sort of for the first time elected a Democrat, but they were hardly like screaming, you know, left-wing radicals or something, to statewide office. And I mean, Henry Mello, for example, you know, was not exactly off the left end of the spectrum, but, you know, for this town, they considered him the left. I mean, he was Democrat when there had been Republicans everywhere all the time before that. So, when I ran this protest campaign, I had, only council meetings I'd ever been to had been oral communication at 7 o'clock to protest about the health center issue and things like that, and neighborhood stuff about the closing our branch library down. I'd never been to a regular city council meeting, and I came in first out of 19 candidates, and there I was on the city council. Oh my God, they don't just meet in the evening at 7 o'clock; they meet in the afternoon. But I have a job now. What's going to happen? Stuff I had never thought through, because I literally thought I was involved in a protest campaign I could never win. So it was a shock to me as much as everybody else when I got elected the first time.
You know, I came to California in 1974, and that's when I started to first hear about Santa Cruz. And my contemporaries' children were all graduating from high school, and I was working in Pasadena at the time, and they were all talking about Santa Cruz. And I think that really, when the university came to town, was when the conservative element started to change.
And, oh, absolutely.
And so
yeah.
From 65 on, as more and more young people came into the community.
Now, when you say they were all talking about Santa Cruz.
Move to Santa Cruz, to come to UCSC.
I see.
Their children were all vying to enter UCSC.
And at the time, the university had a reputation as a kind of place for free thinkers. There was a narrative evaluations rather than grades and interdisciplinary studies.
That's the way it was when I was a student
and
there,
At that time, there was no engineering school, no business school, or even a business program, for that matter. And I think, and there's no football team. Let's talk about serious issues for the local town. And so it didn't, it was a kind of place that tended to invite people who wanted to play intramural sports with their friends rather than sort of think about big team sports and, you know, getting getting grades being the most important thing in your life. So it did tend to attract more kind of, let's just describe them, free thinking, somewhere in those days more left wing because that was the politics of that period. But by itself, I don't think the university, there's lots of progressive universities that are in very conservative towns. I think it also took a lot of direct involvement of people in neighborhoods over, and for example, environmentalism, which I think is less and less a kind of left-wing thing. It's something, for example, in Santa Cruz that sometimes very conservative people support, the idea we ought to limit growth, have it be, you know, a community that doesn't sprawl like San Jose or something. So I think the politics were beginning to change, not just from the university, but also in terms of what people in town were, they didn't want to become a suburb of San Jose.
I agree with you. I remember Measure J and Measure O circa 1978. Measure O was the city anti-growth measure or growth management.
Yeah, that was 1979 March, actually. That was my first, that was the same election that I first won on.
So was that a little after Measure J in the county, which was a growth management issue? And I
Measure
remember
J,
that for sure in 78.
And Measure J was in 78, and then in 79 it was met with Measure O in the city. And those were growth limitation measures that passed, for example, the Measure O, which created a green belt around the city of Santa Cruz. It was at that time just a moratorium that stopped growth until it was eventually purchased and set a growth rate for the city. We had been growing at 4% a year, which is a huge growth rate. And this thing mandated nothing more than 2% growth per year. And
Was that a cast in stone number, or was that
No, it actually required, what it said was the city council could set a growth rate and establish housing permits was the way it was going to be regulated.
Yeah.
And they set 2.0 was set as the growth rate. It could have been higher or lower than that. It was up to, as Measure J has the same model, the you have to have a public hearing to decide what the growth should be. And Measure O passed in every precinct in the city of Santa Cruz. So it was not something just voted for by the students or left-wing folks in the left-wing districts in Santa Cruz. It was very, very popular as a concept.
We're talking with City Councilman, City of Santa Cruz, City Councilman Mike Rotkin. We also have in the studio City of Santa Cruz Director of Redevelopment, Seal Cirillo. We're sort of getting a background of how things were in Santa Cruz and how they evolved to how they are and so forth. And growth management has always been a particular favorite topic of mine. And I do agree with you, Mike, that it's something that conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats seem to universally agree on. Even the Republicans who are more free market types, like myself, I'm registered as a Republican, but I have no use for either party, to tell you the truth. But I do happen to be a free market type person, and don't believe in artificial controls of things. But in any case, I think I probably voted for Measure J and Measure O back then, you know, and I don't know that I would. I might right now, but I might, because some of the people that you would least expect to vote those kinds of rules in, when they get into the voting booth, they say, the best way to wreck a place is for more people to come, you know, no matter what side of the political fence.
Because traffic congestion is maybe the single big, but people ask, what's their biggest concern in your life right now?
Yeah.
They might, if they get pushed into an international level, you know, the war in Iraq or something. But if you ask people about local issues, your daily life, what happens to you, traffic congestion always tops the list. It hasn't for decades here in town.
And if there had not been growth management, do you think that it would be even worse than it is, or do you think it would be the same as it is? Because there was growth management, the infrastructure was not allowed to grow.
I think your quality of life would be totally different. That's where the major impact would have been realized, is on the quality of life that we have currently, and that makes us love this city so much.
You know, one of the ironies is, and we're sure we'll get into this, is at that point there was such a sense that growth was like being pushed on us from outside, that the state growth rate was huge, that the people who wanted to commute to jobs in San Jose were just overwhelming the town. And at that time, housing was, you know, when I first got elected, relatively cheap still. And there had been, when I bought a house here that's worth over $1 million now, not because of my work, but just because of the land value changes. Yeah. I bought it for $26,000. You know, $26,000 to $1 million on an investment in a piece of, it's a double lot, you know, that's close to the ocean.
What, 30 years is it?
I bought the house in 73.
Oh, okay.
For $26,000 and or 75 for $23,000 and $26,000 and so this and the rents when I first got here I paid $70 a month for a two bedroom with a yard. So you know people who are living here now anybody can has a sense of what had changed. So people with the pressure to find a place to live here every vacant lot was being bought up. People were building everything they could possibly build, and there was a sense of the town was just being overwhelmed. To the point that, again, the solutions for traffic were, that they were considering were things like this, you know, let's make it Ocean Street 8 lanes, let's double-deck Mission Street, and things that would have made it a very different kind of a town had those kinds of things developed. Or imagine what would happen if there had been 10,000 people instead of state parks and stuff up on the North Coast and agriculture. You would have had traffic coming down Mission Street. We think we have problems on Mission Street now. What would have happened with 10,000 more people on the north side of the city? And that was the plan in 1964 general plan. As two communities of 5,000 each on the Wilder and Scaroni ranches.
Yeah.
And so I think we saved this town in a lot of ways by those actions. But one of the ironies is we were so set on opposing every bit of growth, every, you know, I don't want to see another car. I don't want to see anything happen that develops anything near me. I don't want to see another building go up one more story in the whole place. We created this kind of a sense of absoluteness about growth is always bad, it always causes problems. And again, I don't think it was the left. I think it was something that was shared pretty widely by people in town. But now we have a problem, which is under the conditions you need to fund a city. What does it take to get money to run a police department? What is it going to take to pave the streets? What kind of schools do you want to have for your kids?
You notice that?
It, for me, as an issue, it began becoming a little bit clearer towards the end of the 80s. I mean, up till then, we were still engaged in this, you know, heroic battle against stopping the growth that was going to destroy us. And as a council member, I mean, I was always in favor of seeing some kinds of economic development. But the idea that every project that we now propose, and it happens to us pretty steadily, I don't think I'm overstating this, almost every proposed project has opposition, not because of the particular design of the building or they didn't plan it well, how the traffic's going to enter the street from its driveways or things, which might have been a problem in the past. But just every vacant lot seen by some people in town is seen as better than a development. You never see one more story on a building. That's a terrible thing to have happen. And so this is something that redevelopment confronts and something that the city as a whole faces. Every time we propose a project, a hotel that might make some money for the city, a building downtown that might actually provide jobs for people, or even housing, you know, affordable housing as a goal, there's opposition that pops up and people go, well, that's going to create 25 more cars. We've had people, I'm not exaggerating this, for three new units on a street, in a little apartment complex with three houses in it. And people go, well, the traffic impacts are just going to be horrible on our street. How much traffic impact is there from, you know, a little development with three, you know, so they have two cars each, so six cars on the street. I don't think it's going to destroy the quality of people's lives. But there is this sense that the cumulative impact of every little bit of growth is terrible and it's going to destroy us. So, ironically, those of us who fought growth and felt, you know, that's what's critical to make this a livable town, now trying to find ways to fund city government, build a building for a, you know, a useful project, a new school.
And are you?
And so I find myself in this ironic place where now people are thinking, well, that Mike, he's Mr. Pro-Development. He wants to pave the place over. People are telling us we're trying to build a bicycle path. And some of your listeners may have views on this.
You still get reelected by pretty handy margins when you run.
I think people see me now, I hope, at least because I try. This is what I believe in, is that we have to be very careful about, you know, we have limited resources. There's not much land left that hasn't been developed. Some of it can be redeveloped because it's not being used to, you know, very good capacity. But there's very little left in the way of a lot of space or resources. So I still believe we shouldn't just build things for the sake of building them. I'm not in favor of building more, you know, huge numbers of new homes for the super wealthy or something out there on the edges of our town. But we should be in favor of some reasonable developments that will provide good jobs for people and actually provide people with the kind of services that they need. And so I'm in this place now and more kind of in the middle. And I think for example, the precincts that used to vote against me overwhelmingly, completely, you know, never wouldn't even consider. For the worst precinct for me in the city up in Prospect Heights, I got 300 votes against me and 6 votes for me. in my first election. And now that's a place where I got a majority of the votes in the last election. And so it's, you know, the question of what's liberal, what's environmental, what's, I think all those labels and categories have just been blown up in this town. They don't exist in the way they did before.
Yeah. Seal, tell us about redevelopment. What is redevelopment? I always, when you say the word to me, I think of money. One of the few places in government that has some money.
Well,
but I don't know anything about it.
Redevelopment,
just my impression.
Redevelopment was enacted back in the 50s in California, and more communities adopted redevelopment plans after Proposition 13 was enacted by the voters of California, and it was a source of funding for local governments to use in areas that are blighted. The essence of redevelopment is the elimination of blight. Economic circumstances are blighting influences, so we are able to use redevelopment as a source to mitigate or work on economic development type projects. We are not able to use redevelopment funds directly for contributions to developers, except in a manner in which we can show there's a public benefit.
Where do these redevelopment funds come from? And is my impression wrong that you're loaded with money?
We're not loaded with money. The school
district, relatively speaking,
they come
relative
from
relative to other government agencies.
The source of the revenue is incremental taxes, property taxes that are realized from the date the project area is adopted. In our community, the project areas were adopted in 1990. The school districts still get their resources, their same tax revenues, as does the county. So there is an incremental or an increase in property taxes as a result of new development. However, when the public acquires properties, those properties come off the tax roll. So there's a diminutive amount that comes to the agency as a result of those kinds of activities.
So, for example, you take Coast Hotel as a concrete example.
Used to be the Dream Inn, yeah.
Yeah, well, some of us still tend to call it that, but I was on radio, so I thought I'd use the real name.
Yeah.
So the Coast Hotel was worth a certain amount of money, its property that it sits on, the property values for the building and the property. And if you, say, tear that down, decide that it's become a blighted area in some way, and that it's really, it's in terms of economic possibilities, it's not functioning the way it should, and then you rebuild a new hotel that's worth a lot more, the difference in property tax between what it was before and what it's worth now goes to the redevelopment agency after you take out some for the schools. You know, you have to make sure that you don't take away taxes from others. But the money that otherwise would simply be property tax going to the state ends up coming to the local community, and you get to use it through the redevelopment agency. And again, it can only be used on public type purposes. You can't fund social services out of it, for example. Usually it's much more sort of for physical development, like fixing the streets, the sewer system, the issues of creating new jobs for people.
That's
like
what
that
happened here out in front of the radio station. There was a county redevelopment project, 12 years ago or thereabouts, where they installed curbs and gutters and sidewalks.
Right, and what they did is they took the increasing property value, once they declared it as a redevelopment area, and that was Live Oak, where there was no curbs and gutters and problems of standing water issues and a lot of significant sort of physical problems in the street structure and the storm drain structure, things like that. Jan Buttes took leadership as a county supervisor in sort of pressing this to become a redevelopment area. Once it's declared so, the general rise in property values that are taking place throughout Santa Cruz County, which were dramatic. I just gave the example of my house values. It's very similar throughout the county. That additional value of land and property basically becomes transferred to the county's redevelopment agency, or the Live Oak Area Redevelopment Agency, and then the county government, which runs that agency, is able to spend that money on stuff to fix up Live Oak.
But doesn't the property have to transfer in order for the property tax to change under the terms of Prop 13?
No, well, not necessarily. If you're doing new development on it, you're the value of that new construction gets added onto the
tax roll. I understood that.
Well, let me just give you the situation in Live Oak, for example, with all of the infrastructure improvements that have been made, that has provided development opportunities for the private sector, because the streets and public improvements in those areas have been upgraded, so it makes it easier for development to private development to occur. So there's added tax increment to the county as a result of that new development.
Well, I remember before I had the station, people before us, Fuller Jeffrey Broadcasting Company, they purchased the radio stations. There were two of them at the time, an AM and an FM, and the real estate. And this was in 1985 or 86. The first thing they did was go before the Coastal Commission and the planning department here and secured a permit to double the size of this building. I think they had much bigger plans for it. Mm-hmm. And they would have done that, but my understanding was they got very angry when the county said to them, as a condition of issuing this permit, you're going to have to install like 300 or 400 or 500 feet of curb, gutter, and sidewalk.
That's the power that cities and counties have had, you know, since the term
police power, I guess, or whatever you call it.
Yeah, and so basically you're able to say, well, if the public needs to have sidewalks, and if you own a piece of property and you're going to get economic gain from developing it, we can attach reasonable. You can't take money from people because they're doing a development and, you know, basically extort from them money to do things that you might think make sense somewhere else. But you can say, you know, in front of each person's property, there should be sidewalks, and it's a reasonable thing to request of a developer that they put a sidewalk in front of what they're developing so the public can get to where their business is.
In any case, the owners of the station at that time in 1985, 86 decided that that was not reasonable, so they said, to heck with it, we're not going to.
Well, let me give you an example of something.
And then it was done later through the redevelopment. So it has been done, but it wasn't done. It wasn't paid for by the private property owner.
No, because redevelopment takes the money from an area that's, again, that's blighted by definition and finds a way to create this money through the tax increment and puts that money back into the area to make it improved quality of the area, which hopefully in turn generates more economic development and therefore more money back to the agency. It can be a very positive loop, in effect, in which you take real changes in values.
Tide raises all ships.
What I didn't...
You're being sarcastic, I know.
No, like I'm not being sarcastic.
I think it's true.
I'm not being sarcastic. Yeah. I believe that.
What I didn't add on to the description of redevelopment is that 25% of the annual tax increment that the agency receives, which amounts to a little over $1 million a year, the 25% goes to a low moderate income housing fund, which we commit to the development of affordable housing. And the agency has spent a significant amount of money to create a number of affordable housing units, and most of them have been with the nonprofit sector, but we have worked with the private sector also. And one of the our practice has been that if a project, in order for it to proceed, need some assistance to make it financially or economically feasible, we have recommended that the new net tax increment from that project go back into the project. We did that in the 1010 Pacific Avenue in order to get affordable housing units in that project. We did it in 1240 Schaefer Road. All of the tax increment for the next 25 years goes back into that project and reduces. It goes as rent subsidy for 40% of the units. There are 210 units in that project, so 80 of them are at low and very low income rents for low and very low income families. That the project is supporting itself from tax increment, that, and that's typically how the agency has worked. The other The other major one we did the same thing on was at 150 Chestnut Street, which was Maynard Manson's development at Laurel and Chestnut.
That's the old Union Ice
right,
company.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right, and the agency took the tax increment that came from that project and put it back into the project to assist that project to happen.
One of the reasons that they have the redevelopment law has this requirement that you pump back a certain amount of the money that's generated into affordable housing is because when redevelopment started back in the 50s at the national level, typically they would take neighborhoods that were blighted. They were definitely run down, slum housing and so forth, and they would create redevelopment agency, would generate a huge amount of money, and then they would rebuild in that area a bunch of, say, industrial or commercial development with no housing. And the people who had lived there before were pushed out of the neighborhood. We used to call it Negro removal instead of urban renewal, you know, in Washington, D.C. This is for people who are sympathetic to African Americans, were saying, in effect,
Negro,
you know,
removal.
Because what it was doing was every time you'd go into a bad neighborhood, there'd be redevelopment money coming from the tax increment. They would build a bunch of public buildings or commercial spaces and things, and all the people that lived there would have to go look for housing somewhere else. And so I think as they developed California redevelopment law, people began thinking, we need to find some way to make sure that the result of redevelopment is not constantly destruction of all residential units and replacement with commercial stuff at the expense of people having a place to live. So I think in that sense, there's a balance that they're trying to achieve in the process, and we actually in the city of Santa Cruz, it's not by law, but now by policy, have been spending about 30% of our redevelopment increment on housing rather than the 25% we're required to do by law. But it varies from year to year exactly what the percent is, but we spend a somewhat higher percentage than other communities on housing.
Let's turn to a discussion, pardon me, of the university and the pardon me, the city of Santa Cruz relationship with the university. Now, you come from the university, Mike, and I was amused some years back when you expressed, I forgot the particulars of the project involved, but you were outraged at some project that the university
Robert Sinsheimer was chancellor, and he had the idea of doing an industrial park up above in the woods up above Crown and Merrill College.
Okay.
And
sort of an R&D center or something?
Exactly. And the problem was that there's so little access to the campus. It comes on High Street and Bay Street. That's the only two little roads that are neighborhood streets, basically, that go to the university. And the idea of building this huge development, which would have been about the size of their plan for it was about the size of downtown Santa Cruz in terms of, you know, the actual building footage that they'd be constructing in this place would be huge.
Right.
And I think a lot of us were very, very concerned that the result of this would be destruction of the whole West Side, upper West Side neighborhood in terms of traffic.
And the university, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think the university could have done it and just, you know, thumbed its nose at you and the city of Santa Cruz or anybody who didn't want it, because they don't have to go through a planning process.
No, that's exactly right. But I think what happened is there was the vote of the people on that, which was about, I think it was at the time, 79%. I may have it wrong, but it was a pretty large majority of people saying don't build this thing. It was an advisory measure. We had no control over them. It was enough of a signal that what they were doing was really, really unpopular with the local community that they decided maybe they wouldn't proceed with it. Then there also was a change in economic conditions, the accidents of the market and stuff, that their plans, which looked like they would fill the place up with all kinds of huge development instantly,
right,
maybe might not have been quite as successful as they had hoped. And for a variety of reasons that I have probably not aware of, they finally decided just to drop the whole project.
I was amused by that whole thing is because up until then, the people who didn't like the university in the town were people who felt that their town had been taken from them by the university vote.
Right.
You know, younger, which has been, or had been, what's the word? Validated, I guess.
Right.
By a Superior Court judge somewhere, right?
Well, actually what happened is there were two changes in the law. We moved the voting age from 21 to 18, and I think that was largely a result of the war in Vietnam and the sense that we were sending like young men off to die and wouldn't let
right.
them vote. That's not the only reason, but I think that was a big impact. And, of course, the whole youth generation impact on the importance of youth, the economy and stuff like that. And the other change was the Supreme Court in California decided that any person who was of voting age of 18 or older could vote in the community in which they resided after they lived there for 30 days. And the idea that, as in the past, students have been told, well, go vote in your home community, but you can't vote in town here, was made illegal by the California Supreme Court. And as a result, basically students have huge voting block power in university towns. And that was the legal change that allowed the university to have more of an impact on local politics. Now, I have to say, a lot of times, and I think university did have an impact on local politics, but I think a lot of it was kind of indirect. Because students were here, all of a sudden you had these companies. There was one record store in Santa Cruz in 1969 when I came here.
Burdick Santa Cruz Music Center.
And now there, how many? There must be 15 music stores. There were two bookstores. Two bookstores in all of Santa Cruz in 1969 when
I came
here.
The Hip Pocket Bookstore,
which later became Bookshop Santa Cruz, right, through a series of changes and logos.
Uh-huh.
Paper Vision had some books, but it was not. It was more of a stationery store. And that was it for the bookstores in this town. And so now there must be 100 bookstores in Santa Cruz. Well, the people that run these stores are like young people who will tend to have more progressive politics than the folks that have been here before. Also, the business, the dress shops, the stores that cater to student purchasing power, because the downtown when I came in 69 had been boarded up. I mean, we were having economic problems in downtown Santa Cruz, and the coming to the university brought economic possibilities to the local community, and with it a sort of change in people's views. Now, in 1996, actually, Bill Domhoff, as a sociologist up at the university, actually studied that very directly. How many students vote in Santa Cruz? Because there's a perception out there that students are like half of the vote, and that's what's happened to the town. And in that election in 1996, which I swept in that election, I came in first, and the progressives swept the election, and 12.5% of the voters of Santa Cruz were registered UC students. So it's not half. 12.5% is not nothing. It's a significant little block. It can make a huge difference. But I would not be elected to the Santa Cruz City Council if my only voters were UC students or even former UC students. Mm-hmm. And so there's a perception out there, I think particularly among conservatives, that, gosh, the university's brought these aliens to town and they now like vote in this weird way that's totally different than our culture. But the reality is the views of the people in town have changed dramatically. And again, I think environmentalism was kind of the wedge that pushed that political change. It's not just student voters that have changed Santa Cruz political outlook.
I think the complexion of the students has changed since 1996 also.
For one thing, it's become more conservative. I mean, just directly. I won in my first election on campus 9-1. And in the last election, I was only winning 2-1. So it's like, I still won on campus, but it's not the absolute, it's all mine and nobody can compete with me up there or something. So I think there's been some changes. And again, I'm not saying the students don't have a big impact on local politics. I think they do, but it's just not the idea that it's the students and they're totally different than the people that live in town is just not true anymore.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to a discussion about Santa Cruz with two appropriate people. Mike Rotkin, who is a city council member, and Seal Cirillo, who is the director of the City Redevelopment Agency, City of Santa Cruz. It's your favorite radio station, AM 1080 KSCO. It's the Saturday special with your host, MZ, and pilot in command, Dave Michael. Now, listen, Dave, I think we need to do a commercial break, don't we?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, let's do it. Back in the flash, gang. Stay with us.
Say, it's MZ with a secret for you to feel much better, even if you already feel great. I'm talking about finally cleaning junk and clutter out of your life and about finally taking down that dangerously hanging or dirty tree you've been meaning to deal with forever. Now, I realize it's fall, not spring, but I can assure you that there is no law preventing you from doing spring cleaning in the fall. Okay, here's the secret. Pick up the phone and call Community Tree Service and talk to Regina or Naomi about getting their charming and well-equipped boss, Adolfo, out to your property for a free quote for your tree or cleanup job. Adolfo knows what he's doing and has all the right people and tools to get your job done the right way, on time, and at reasonable cost. Don't put it off any longer. Call Community Tree Service now at 763-2391 and set the wheels in motion for you to feel much better. Community Tree Service and Dumpster Rental, 763-2391. That's 763-2391. Call now.
This is Bill Lambert of Lambert & Son Moving, your local family-owned and operated mover, serving the entire Monterey Bay region for local moves and relocations throughout the state of California. Call Bill Lambert at 420-0419 for a free, no-obligation estimate. Moving advice is always free, no job too small or too large. Our staff at Lambert & Son Moving is really exceptional. Our crews are trained movers who are careful, polite, courteous, and trustworthy. We never hire temporary labor, only trained, skilled, professional movers. Lambert & Son Moving also offers local delivery from the Santa Cruz Costco. We have delivered a lot of big-screen TVs, refrigerators, washers and dryers, and sectional sofas from Costco. Give Bill a call for details at 420-0419. Let our family take care of your family's move. 420-0419. Or go online at www.lambertmoving.com.
Hey, it's MZ. I want to share one of my very private emails with you. It's from the famous Andy of Kitchen Express in response to my request for him to email me bullet points for his new ad. Hey, MZ, here are the bullet points. Celebrating our 10th anniversary and have become Santa Cruz's oldest continuously owned kitchen and bath showroom, recently voted Santa Cruz County's number one kitchen and bath showroom by my son. Featuring 12 lines of custom and modular cabinets for all areas of the house, for all budgets, with over 20 years of experience and expert computer kitchen design and consultation. We know our stuff. Countertop headquarters for Corian, Silestone, Caesarstone, and Zodiacqua quartz counters. Nobody does it better or quicker. Decorative plumbing fixtures for kitchen and bath. Come see our working shower demonstration featuring multiple shower heads and working steam shower. Come and take a shower. Extensive selection of cabinet hardware. Up to 60% off every day. Thanks, MZ. Andy. Kitchen Express is located on the Frontage Road just off of Highway 1 at Rio Del Mar. Exit 662-3700.
If you're thinking about buying or selling a home, then you need to listen to this message. If you're buying or selling real estate, you need the right realtor to represent you. That realtor is Randy Turnquist, a 36-year resident of Santa Cruz County that really knows the market. What is a good market? Randy will give you the facts and let you decide based on current market statistics. Many potential sellers or buyers don't think they need a realtor until they're ready to buy or sell. That is simply not the case. Buying or selling real estate is one of the biggest things you'll do in life. Don't wait until you need a realtor to shop for one. Start building that relationship now with Randy Turnquist Realtor. You can reach Randy at 1-888-496-9655 or go to www.ksco.com, look for the big yellow box and put in Realtor. You'll go directly to Randy's website. If you're looking to buy, here are a few of Randy's listings. Santa Cruz Gardens, 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath, $739,000. 3-bedroom condo in Watsonville, $449,000. For more information on these properties or other properties, call Randy Turnquist Realtor at 1-888-496-9655.
Okay, welcome back to the closing few moments of, actually we've got about 7 minutes left in hour number one of the KSCO Saturday Special. Guests, Cecil Cirillo from the Redevelopment Agency in Santa Cruz City and Mike Rotkin, Santa Cruz City Council person. We are going to open the phone lines up next hour, so you'll be able to call in and ask questions, make comments to Cecil and Mike. I think we're going to get more into the discussion of the university relationship with the community. I've always seen this as an amazing resource that the city should have been taking advantage of for many years, and I don't quite understand the reason why it hasn't. And maybe things are going to change now with a new chancellor who seems to be interested in improving the relationships between the town and the gown, as it's called. Maybe. I mean, that would be nice. I mean, that's something I've always wished for, and I've always hoped that KSCO Radio could play a role in that, because it's an amazing resource, the University of California.
Well, it's interesting because there are a lot of people in town. Again, this doesn't sort of not defined as left or right, but a lot of people in town who really don't like the university, perhaps for ideological reasons, but often because just the scope of the impact of the growth. Then every time they bring more students, there's more traffic. We're back to the growth issue. There's traffic impacts. There's impacts on the housing market. I mean, it drives senior citizens out of housing. This used to be a place where we had. When I moved here in 69, it was 28% over 65. Now it's like 12% over 65.
When I was growing up, Santa Cruz was known as the poor man's place to retire, Monterey being the rich man's place to retire, or Carmel,
right.
That area.
So there's a lot of concern about university growth impacts. And, you know, I'm biting the hand that feeds me because it's my job up there. But the reality is that the campus, if they, and the city council's view has been, it's okay, we support the university growing, actually. We think it's not an unreasonable thing for them to educate people in the state. People have a right to higher education. They should at least access to it. And that's something that's not unreasonable that we, you know, provide that kind of capacity. But if we're going to grow at the campus at UC Santa Cruz, they have to plan the growth in a way that deals with the growth impact. So, for example, there probably is not an automobile solution to how we're going to deal with getting people to the campus. You can't widen the intersections anymore without destroying neighborhoods. So we need some kind of an enhanced public transit access. Right now, half the students take the bus to school, half drive cars or live on campus or have other kinds of, you know, they don't use the bus to get to school. But faculty about 90 and staff about 90% drive, 10% use public transit. And with those kinds of numbers, if you add more students to the campus currently, and their plan is to add 4,500 more students and about 1,800 more faculty and staff.
Is that 20% more? No, more than that, huh?
Yeah, that's quite a bit. Uh-huh. It's a 50%. Well, they're at 15,000 now. You add 4,500. I'm not quick at the math, but it's about a 30% increase or something along those lines. In any case, it's, you know, you're talking about, just do some rough math, something like another 3,000 cars at the Bay Mission intersection every afternoon if they fill that growth out and there's not some other way to move those people around. So we've taken the position as a city council that the university needs to work with us. They don't have to do this alone, but they need to work with us on developing an alternative transportation mode, maybe a people mover of some kind up to the campus along the edge of the Poganip, or perhaps some enhanced bus system capacity through what's called bus rapid transit, where the buses have a special lane of their own and go through the traffic signals with priority. Whatever it is, something different has to happen. And you can't just like have a better traffic signal at Bay and Mission. It's not going to handle 3,000 more cars.
What about
been our fight with the university. They want to grow. We haven't said you can't grow. We just said, look, plan for this growth. Tell us how you're going to handle the traffic. Come up with a plan. Pay your fair share of the cost of that.
Do they even need to do that? Can't they do all the building and development on campus they want without consulting the city?
That's the case, but as it turns out, California law, this was a case called Marina versus CSUMB, a U.S. California Supreme Court decision, that universities are responsible for paying the costs of their impacts off campus for their growth. Now, they don't have
to
consult.
I'm happy to hear that, but how
they don't have
that
to consult with us. That's the problem. It's done. It's enforced through California Environmental Quality Act. And what the city's done successfully, we sued the university, and the judge locally, Judge Burdick, threw out their environmental impact document because he said, this document doesn't address the water impacts, the sewer impacts, and the traffic impacts. Now, we can't tell them what to do. The city of Santa Cruz has no control over their, you know, planning, how they're going to do it, what the solutions are. But we can apparently, through the law, force them to at least produce an honest environmental document that will say, what are these impacts going to be? And state law, under the CSUMB Marina decision, can force them to actually try and address these problems. That's not city council power or city power. That has to do with state law. But it's a limited power. People shouldn't overstate it, because who gets to make the final decision whether their solution's an adequate solution? That falls back in their lap again. We don't control that. The university does. So we can just keep going back to court saying your environmental document's not adequate. But we can't make them, as we can with other developers in our community, we can't say to them, hey, you need a sidewalk outside of your business, the example you gave earlier. Or if you're going to have 4,500 more students, you better help fund a guideway of some kind up to the campus that students can ride public transit on. So those kinds of solutions, we cannot impose those on the university. All we can do is force them to be honest about the mess they're going to create with all this development. And we've had to go to court to do that. That's not something we can just announce our intention. It took a court case for us to actually force them to redo their environmental document and actually say, what are these growth impacts going to be on this local community?
Interesting stuff. We're going to delve into this quite a bit more during the hour number two of the Saturday special, coming your way right after news at the top of the hour right here on your favorite radio station and mine, AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, San Jose. I think the clock says 11 o'clock. Here's Fox News. I think we'll be back in 6 minutes or so. Stand by.
Fox News Radio, I'm Rod Fritz. Work to contain those California wildfires continues, but now there are other problems to contend with. the loss of power and air pollution, and the arson investigation continues.
ATF agent and profiler Ron Tunkel says one thing they do know about these people.
For the more organized arsonists, particularly a serial arsonist, we tend to see a conscious indifference to society.
Tunkel says it's also a matter of anger. Someone very angry at something or everything, and he deals with it with fire.
Fox News Radio's Rich Johnson. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger will discuss the firefighting efforts in Orange County later this hour, but he does have a word of warning for homeowners there. Watch out for the con men, who always seem to take advantage during times of crisis. The U.S. commander says security for the Shiite region of Karbala in Iraq will be turned over to the Iraqis on Monday. Major General Rick Lynch says, though, that U.S. troops will be at the ready should they be needed. Situation along the Iraqi border with Turkey, still very tense. Threats of Turkey invading Iraq to attack Kurdish rebels continue. No new talks scheduled. There have been some skirmishes along the border, though.
About 24 of those limited offenses have been going on, but nothing major that we've seen so far. They're ready to launch at any time, though. There are 100,000 Turkish troops lined up on the border, and they're all pointing towards northern Iraq. They might be waiting to meet with President Bush, the Turkish side, before they make a move. Turkey's prime minister has a meeting with President Bush in a week, and the defense minister said nothing will happen until after that meeting.
That's Fox's Caroline Shively in Washington. And a done deal, the United Auto Workers Union's members have approved a 4-year contract with Chrysler, even though there was a lot of dissent from some of the local members. The union says 51% of skilled trade workers and 56% of production workers okayed this contract. You're listening to Fox News Radio. Fair and balanced.
Here's another encore presentation from Fox News Channel.
The stars of the show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, actors Danny DeVito and Caitlin Olson. How do you like this show?
Oh, I love the show. This is my favorite of all shows.
Beats Taxi.
Well, Taxi was done in 1979. This is, you know, edgy, kind of far out. We have a great time. Really stretch the envelope. Not even stretch it. We tear it up in little pieces.
Caitlin, so on the show, what kind of a father is he? A loving, caring, supportive.
None of those things sound right. No.
Does limoncello come up in this show?
Limoncello will come up in this show because I'm, you know, selling it now.
Well, I have this bottle in my hand, as a matter of
That's
fact.
That's it.
This is Danny DeVito's limoncello,
yes.
Original, and it comes with a scratch and sniff label.
Danny DeVito's Premium Limoncello.com.
Danny DeVito's Premium Limoncello.com.
Yeah.
Be listening for more encore presentations from Fox News Talk.
An extreme makeover planned for a Washington landmark.
The site where former President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated will soon become a much larger and high-tech place to learn about the nation's 16th president. The Ford's Theater will become part of a 6-building complex. It'll feature new exhibits, multimedia educational displays, and even a touchscreen where visitors will feel like they're peering over the shoulder of Honest Abe. The reopening scheduled for the bicentennial of Lincoln's birth in 2009. Mary Regal, Fox News Radio.
Pro football players using their passports to play this weekend.
The first ever NFL.
Two of the biggest teams and
from America, the Miami Dolphins cheerleaders.
The Cross Pond Football Classic is billed as an unmissable event in the land of cricket and soccer.
Well, that's why you guys will like the kicker, and hopefully I'll get a lot of the cheers.
Dolphins place kicker Jay Feely. 500,000 football fans tried to buy tickets to the game Sunday. That high demand fuels promoters' hopes for football's expansion to Europe. But in one pub in London, some English sports fans say they have no time for the NFL.
I don't understand it, so I don't watch it.
So might a little cheerleader routine cheer him up?
Yeah, I would think so.
In London, Alistair Wanklin, Fox News Radio.
World Series moves to Denver tonight, Game 3. Dave Anthony is in Denver, has a preview of the lineup.
Up 2-0 and in the driver's seat, the Red Sox hope to ride their expensive Japanese import to victory tonight in Colorado. $100 million pitcher Daisuke Matsuzaka starts for Boston, looking to further cool the once red-hot Rockies, who scored just 2 runs in their last 2 losses in Boston. Colorado counters with Josh Fogg, who will try to shut down a Red Sox team that's averaged a run per inning in their last 5 games. In Denver, Dave Anthony, Fox News Radio.
It'll be cold out there, Coors Field, too. Temperatures expected in the upper 30s to low 40s. Game time, 8:35 Eastern on Fox TV. I'm Rod Fritz, Fox News Radio.
Good morning, everyone. You're tuned in to AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz. It's Saturday, October 27th.
2007. Today's forecast calls for partly cloudy skies. Highs around 71 degrees with winds south-southwest, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight will be partly cloudy with lows around 50 degrees. Winds light and variable. Tomorrow you can expect it to start out partly cloudy, giving way to mainly sunny skies in the afternoon. Highs around 75 degrees. And tomorrow night, partly cloudy conditions can be expected with lows around 51 degrees. Today's Monterey Bay boaters forecast, light southeast winds becoming west, 5 to 10 knots in the afternoon with wind waves 1 foot or less, and a northwest swell 2 to 4 feet at 19 seconds. Outside the studios, it is 58 degrees. The time is 11:05, and it's time to take you to hour number two of the Saturday Special with your host, MZ.
My goodness, Dave, we have a caller. There's a caller.
Holy moly.
Oh, my God. We got to find out who it is and what they want to say so that we can screen them out if we don't want to hear from them. All right. Let's get back to the officially open the hour number two of your Saturday Special.
Oh, hello, darling. I hate to hang up on you, but I'm sorry, baby, but I have to go. It's time for that wonderful record show. I'd love to visit, but you'll have to call back. KSCO has the inside track.
All right, welcome to hour number two of this discussion. Yeah, the discussion about City of Santa Cruz and its relationship with the university. I think we're going to keep it to that.
I'm sorry, baby, but I really got to go to KSCO Radio. Bye.
Okay, during the break, I was sharing with Mike Rotkin and Seal Cirillo an experience that I had here. This was in 1992. Year after we got the radio station, and I was interviewing Chancellor Dean McHenry. I mean, he was a former chancellor back then, Chancellor Emeritus. And during that interview, and I've got to find somewhere I got a tape of that. I mean, I should pull that up and put it on the website or something like that on KSCO.com. Sometime during that interview, he said to me, "Never, Michael, in a million years did I dream that University of California, my dream institution, Oxford, you know, college, cluster college, educational institution concept would become an institution of indoctrination rather than education." And I said, "Whoa, that's coming from you." And so anyhow, I think if that's probably the biggest reason that people have in the city for not liking the university, because they think it's not really, whether this is true or not, that they think it's that the perception of the university is that it's a place where the left will indoctrinate the future, you know, socialists and communists, you know, of tomorrow and so forth. But I know that the university is much more than that. I believe that it is a tremendous, tremendous resource that this community has not even begun to take advantage of and tap. And it seems like this George Blumenthal, acting chancellor, now official chancellor, is someone who wants to have better relations between the institution and the community. And both of you seem really excited about that and really hopeful.
We've already begun to experience that. While he was acting chancellor, he reached out in many ways to us in our efforts to work cooperatively.
Give us an example.
Well, the commitment of making the space available at the 2300, we're calling it the 2300 Delaware Building.
It's the former TI building over on the west side.
And
the university owns that?
The university has owned it for several years. It's a space that we've been talking with them about, and there is a commitment from them to make available space for what we call a technology transfer center or an incubator. We have been working with the Office of Intellectual Property and the Vice Chancellor for Research and Development on what opportunities there might be to bring some of the technology that is emerging from the campus into the business world. That's one of
that
our...
That seems like a great idea to me.
No, we know that, you know...
And for those of us who were disappointed that the R&D center, you know, that was proposed in the mid-'80s
right.
for the university didn't happen.
You know,
it didn't seem to me that was that long ago, but you guys know. It seems to me that maybe this is something that can be what that could have been. And
there is the potential for that. We took two tours of the campus about a year ago of local community members and city council members and department heads to view what is emerging there and what kinds of research is happening on campus. And I can't tell you how impressed the whole group that toured the facilities. There's the new engineering building and then the adaptive optics building on campus. And I encourage anyone in the community who has the opportunity to tour the campus facilities to see the magnificent work that's going on there.
Hmm. And is that a surprise to you, Mike? Because you're...
No, I've dealt with lots of chancellors on campus. I've been there since McHenry was the chancellor. And I'm excited, and I think the whole council was excited by George Blumenthal's appointment. In fact, we were often asked by the media and other, you know, what do you think about the acting chancellor becoming the permanent chancellor? And we always had to kind of restrain our enthusiasm and figure, like, if we like him, maybe that'll be a reason not to appoint him. So we try to keep it quiet. But I think he's a very good listener. I think he's taught at UC Santa Cruz for since the campus opened almost, you know, and since the early 70s. And as a result, I think he's somebody who understands a lot about the local community. He's got, I think, reasonable, he shares our concerns about some of the growth impacts. I think the big test is going to be whether he, as a chancellor, has the authority to actually implement reasonable solutions or whether he's going to be told, as has often been the case by the Office of the President in Oakland, that you can't do this or, you know, we're going to force you to do that. And that's something that's it's a little early to weigh in on some of those questions. So, I mean, I'll give you an example. We sat down, council members, with the chancellor and with even some of the vice chancellors and talked about the growth impacts and said, do you think there's a car solution to the 4,500 more students and 1,800 more faculty and staff? Say, well, no, we have to come up with some kind of a public transit solution. Well, then how come your environmental impact report doesn't talk about that? Because it doesn't have to. You know, it comes. They fall back into this kind of envy. In fact, what they're really saying is the president's office has told us, you're not going to, like, you know, work out a deal with the city of Santa Cruz. We're going to do what's good for us, and we'll figure out what that is, and we're going to impose it. And I don't think that's because the local people, the local leadership of the campus wants to approach it that way. I think that kind of stuff is pushed on them by the past president's office. Now, there's a change going on. Dines, the former president's leaving. He's announced his retirement at the end of the year, academic year, in June or July 1st. And we'll see what the new president, who the new president's going to be of the university and what their views are going to be about these matters. I would hope we get somebody up there who understands if you're going to grow the university system, which, again, I support, the idea that people get an education in the state, you have to do it in a way that is sensitive to environmental constraints. If there's not enough water, what are you going to do to help develop alternative water sources? If there's traffic problems, you know, that can't be fixed
signal. You can't have a discussion about the university without bringing up the Eastern Access. Whatever happened to the Eastern Access?
There's two issues.
Poganip, you know, that's city property now.
Well, Measure O, one of the things Measure O did, remember we talked about that earlier and how popular it was. I think you voted for it, Michael. You just told us that earlier.
I'm going to throw this back in your face now.
One of the things there is that you can't put urban services across the Greenbelt. Well, the Poganip, which is where the Eastern Access was being thought of, is part of that Greenbelt. So the voters of the city of Santa Cruz, 81% of them, yourself included, have told us you can't build a road across there. So that's what happened to the Eastern Access. But before I go on, let me just quickly say...
I've changed my mind.
Let me just say quickly, there's one... Yeah, that's possible. There's that at this point... there is support from the environmental community for a public transit alternative, not internal combustion engine, but some kind of a guideway or something that would run up along the edge of the Poganip where the Eastern Access route would roughly run. But the biggest problem with the Eastern Access as a car solution is if you take a road, just think about this. You've lived here long enough to get the picture, and many of your listeners, I know, are in that same position. You run it from the campus, and you come down the hill. You're going to end up on Highway 9. River Street on the Harvey West side of Highway 1. You're going to, right now, you're going to, there's already over traffic impacts every afternoon there that are huge and impossible to, going through that 1-9 intersection, which is a complete mess. And you're going to throw that traffic into that intersection. So instead of having traffic come down the hill, Highway 1, with most of the green light time and some traffic coming off of Harvey West Industrial Park, you're going to be now throwing cars into that intersection coming from the other direction. So all you're going to do is slow the cars coming down the hill already in the other, you know, down Highway 1 from Mission Street. So it doesn't, technically it doesn't solve the problem. And there is, and people say, well, yeah, but couldn't the traffic go somewhere else? Well, ask yourself, where else would it go? To Highway 17? That's not where people are trying to get. They're trying to get down to Aptos and down to South County. So how are you going to get an Eastern Access to feed back onto Highway 1 somewhere that's not going to have exactly the same impact that you're currently having? The reason there's backed up traffic on High Street and on Bay Street and all of Mission Street every afternoon is because the Highway 19 intersection and Highway 1 is beyond capacity. And so it's not going to solve the problem to create a new Eastern Access that dumps traffic into that intersection. I understand people's frustration. There must be a solution. You've got to do something. I would just say the solution's not automobiles at this point. And I'm not saying this out of some ideological point of view. I just practically, we need to have some kind of a public transit alternative, get more people, particularly students, on buses or on some kind of people mover or something and get them out of their cars. Because if they're going to stay in cars, there's nowhere to direct that traffic that's not going to make the problem worse.
I'm going to open the phone lines now, 479-1080, if you want to call the radio station, AM 1080 KSCO. If you want to email me, it's mz@ksco.com. I'll put the mailbox here up on the screen if you want to participate that way. If you want to fax us, 475-2967, then call the radio station. Call Dave at 475-1080 and tell him to go up front to retrieve the fax, because otherwise it'll just arrive there and sit there. It's 17 minutes past 11. All I ask, gang, is that you be reasonable with your questions here. Don't ask a question that has nothing to do with Santa Cruz or politics or the way the city is run or the way redevelopment is run. Just don't, you know, save that for an open mic program. And I have a sneaking suspicion that our first caller is going to ask one of those irrelevant questions. I hope I'm wrong. Am I wrong, John? And
you're absolutely wrong.
Okay, good,
Michael.
Good. Okay, good.
All right. Well,
it says spraying and ridiculous lawsuit.
They misquoted me.
Okay. Right.
I'm sure Mike recognizes my voice. I come to council often and rage against some of the outrageous excesses of the city council.
Yes.
I want to lead off by saying the East Side Access issue, Measure O violated an agreement that was in writing between the city and the university and was designed for long growth considerations. I think the East Side Access issue should be given to the brilliant students up there that our state money is paying for. And I know there's solutions, and there's possible merge lanes on the curve around there at 1. You could do one-way roads that are limited to electric vehicles. There's many, many possibilities that don't involve crazy skyways or completely redoing a cloverleaf at River and 1. So I'm suggesting that. I'm suggesting the city cooperate with the university and say, why doesn't the university come up with a creative solution? Now, the other issue here is...
John, let me interrupt just to make one point. That's exactly what the city is proposing, that we work with the university to come up with transportation alternatives, whatever they are. And at this point, again, the local campus, at least to this point, has been told in effect... I mean, I say to this point, it may change next week already, because we're supposed to have mediated discussions about university growth impacts. I'm looking forward to those. I think the campus is. But we've pressed that we have exactly that discussion about how to solve these problems. Up till now, we have not had those discussions, and it took a court suit to even get the university to talk to us about the impacts of their growth. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to stop your point.
Okay. Well, that was my point. That sounds like a reasonable suggestion. But this thing about the CEQA, Mike, and suing the university and now suing the state over the spraying, I think it is so hypocritical that the city deliberately hid their the impacts of the Bay Street Reservoir destruction, deliberate and unwarranted destruction, where thousands of heavy vehicles are going to be impacting the Bay and Mission intersection, and they slipped it into a consent agenda. Intentionally didn't want any debate about it. The water director, Coker, never gave any facts that he could support other than the fact that the roof is presently got a portion damaged.
John, before you go on, let me tell the listeners what you're talking about. Then you can make your point. I don't think the listeners maybe even know what you're talking about. The Bay Street Reservoir, which is up at Bay Street near Cardiff Place, near Bay and High, that reservoir has been around for quite some time, and it was built back actually at the turn of the century, near the turn of the century. And that reservoir holds its treated water that comes from the water treatment plant. It sits up there, and then it gets distributed to the entire west side of Santa Cruz. And we were required by changes in the law to cover, it used to be an open reservoir, to cover
it. I remember it.
To cover it with a roof, and that roof, which was built of wood initially and stuff, has been collapsing, and it's at very clear risk for collapsing. There may be alternatives, but at this point, the water department has decided, looking at all the options and the long-term safety of the basically earthen dam that creates that reservoir right there, that it's not safe for the long term. And so their decision was that, and recommendation of the council, which we adopted, was to replace that reservoir with tanks, water tanks, that in combination, the two tanks we intend to eventually place on the site there, plus one additional new tank we're building, will only give us about two-thirds of the water capacity that we currently have in that reservoir. And that's what John's talking about. So at least you understand the issue that he's concerned. So you go ahead, John.
Well, you haven't advertised the fact that you're going to have half the emergency capacity that you had previous, and there is nothing wrong with that reservoir. And I demonstrated that in the council meeting with the city's own facts. I'm really, what angers me is that city council people don't dig into staff's recommendations, and there's no outside engineering firm that looked at the big picture. Water Director Coker had a couple of meetings with their staff. They don't even have any civil or structural engineers on their own staff. They wouldn't even give the problem to Public Works when that was suggested. But the bottom line here I'm talking about is the city is suing other people for having poor CEQAs, and the city is a very bad example of doing a good CEQA. And I'll bet if you went
it's
on
like the
street,
pot calling the kettle black.
Yeah, Mike, I'll bet if you took a couple people and went out on that west side neighborhood around Bay Street Reservoir and Bay and Mission and just polled people, how many people know there's going to be a couple of thousand heavy truck trips here over the next year that are going to greatly impact the traffic going to the university and that entire busiest intersection, I guess, in the county, is what they said. I'll bet not 5% of those people know about those facts. And you had an opportunity to tell those facts the last time you had an article about this in the Sentinel. You hid it all under the consent agenda. So I say the city has kept it under wraps and is afraid to face the criticism for not planning. There's no reason in the world to tear that reservoir down. There's nothing wrong with it.
A quick response, Mike, before we go to our next caller. Thank you, John.
Just that the city staff and the expert, and we have consulted with experts and engineers, and the city council ultimately were persuaded that there is huge risk with that reservoir and that we need to basically plan its replacement with something that's going to last for the long term. And so all there might be quick fixes for the broken roof. They don't address the basic issue of a 100-year-old earthen dam that really is not going to be stable for the long haul. We don't want to pump a bunch of new money into a bad project. We disagree with John about the risks that are there.
Scott in Boulder Creek, you will be our next caller to the KSCO Saturday Special. By the way, it opens up a line at 479-1080. Give us a call. Scott, you're on.
Hi, Mike.
Hey.
Yeah, during the Metro strike, I was in court, happened to be in court right then, and I saw many skateboarders coming and being convicted for tickets that they had got. So, you know, here we have one government agency, people depending, on on strike, and so they go to an alternative, you know, so they won't be, you know, late for class and lower their GPA. And another government organization, the police, giving tickets, and then a third government organization, the courts, convicting them. My question is, why don't they allow, you were talking about public, you know, transportation up there, a bike lane and, you know, a road, a bike road, and a, you know, for skateboarders and bikes up there at the campus. I mean, it seems like, you know, low pollution and, you know, kids could get around up there. I mean, I'm from the Bay Area, and Berkeley, you know, they don't have any limitations on Cal Berkeley campus about bikes. And sometimes it's irritating, you know, some students, most students are quite polite, but even there they have plenty of room, as they do at UCSC, for such lanes.
Well, let me just say,
You know, you were talking about the benevolence, Mike, Reckling, you were talking about the benevolence of the city in building these housing, okay? Now, I know a guy who owns a trailer park just out of Santa Cruz. He got red tagged. And it turns out his lawyers explained to him that the county has no power to enforce any codes whatsoever because they were behind on the housing. And I suspect that this housing surge is part to remedy that situation. And I have just one third comment. Mike, this is a comment you made about there's this emotionally impact word, kill. You know, that the song, "You're Old Enough to Kill, But Not for Voting," did influence.
Barry McGuire song.
Okay, yeah, you know, Jack Fate chose death rather than to sing that song, among some others, in the Bob Dylan movie, Masked and Anonymous. But if you think about it, you're too young to vote. You know, you're too young to drink. You're too young to vote. I mean, you know, it's not just, you know, it's not killing, it's fighting in a war.
Right.
Is you're old enough to fight in a war? You know, you're not old enough to drink, you're not old enough to vote, but there's certain things, you know, the brain changes as you get past 21, 24, and 25. You know, people, that's why they say if you're, you know, not a conservative, before 30, you have no heart. If you're not a liberal after 30, you know, then you have no brain.
Right.
So anyway, there's these issues, and you know, I'm glad that you've opened up the forum for people to express themselves.
I'm glad you're glad, Scott. Thanks for calling. Here's Ken in Watsonville. You're next on the Saturday special.
At some point, we'll get back to some of the points.
Oh, thank you. Retired from City of Santa Cruz bus system, and I used to go up to the campus all the time. And I think the university is a great facility up there, and the students, they're so bright. I rent three houses that I own to college kids, and I see them walk over to the high street bus, and I know that they do carpool. From one of my houses. I'm in full support of the university and what they're doing up there. And the kids.
Well,
they're just so bright today.
Thank you for letting us know. We appreciate your call to the Saturday special. It's 479-1080, by the way, if you want to give us a call. And be on the radio here on Saturday special with Mike Rotkin and Seal Cirillo. We're talking about various things, Santa Cruz. We're pretty much trying to keep to the topic of the university relation.
Yeah, just quickly, the caller in between there had suggested a possibility of more bike and skateboard access and so forth. The campus has pretty good access for bikes. I ride my bicycle to work up there 2 days a week, typically. The problem is, of course, it's an 800-foot climb. You know, if I only have to go to work and then come home in the evening, I could ride my bicycle. But as a city council member, sometimes I have to go up the hill, come down for a meeting, go back up to a class, come back down again.
And everybody's got a good excuse for not getting the right amount of exercise.
But my point is, I do get a fair amount, but it's like, you know, there's only so many times you want to ride a bicycle up an 800-foot hill. And when you get up on campus, it's not like Davis. You get to ride around from class to class on some easy path. half. I mean, just to get between Oaks College, where I have an office, and if I teach in Merrill, you're talking about going up another 400 feet in the climb between those two between those two places. So, I mean, that ends up being quite a serious ride for getting around. But the campus does have bicycle paths. A lot of students ride bikes to work. The campus has a policy against skateboarding, which I don't have any control over that or know much about why they did it. I'm assuming it's for liability reasons. They're just concerned that kids are going to get hurt or they're going to, like, run into each other or something. But then you'd have to have a different guest on the show to answer the question of why they don't allow skateboarding up there. But they do encourage bike riding. They actually provide a bike trailer that goes from near Long's Drugstore on Mission Street up to the campus every morning. They take 14 bikes on each trailer, and they ride every 15 minutes. You can get so if you don't want to ride up 800 feet, you can ride up on the trailer. And there are some mornings when I choose that option too.
Okay. Mike in Santa Cruz, you are our next caller to the KSCO Saturday Special. You're on.
Yes, I had the luxury of being able to read the report that the city of Santa Cruz put together back in the early 60s to encourage the university to come to Santa Cruz. And if the city had implemented a lot of the things that were in there that haven't been done, we wouldn't be having the problems we have. And the main
such as, Mike?
Eastern Access.
Okay.
And they've...
So you take issue with what Mike said earlier. Even if there was an Eastern Access, there would be other problems that we don't have now.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, how would the
lack of an Eastern Access has really done a lot of destruction to West Side neighborhoods.
How would the Eastern Access work? How would you actually... technically...
That is the main thing that comes to mind. But, you know, the city knew what was coming. This is not a surprise. And I feel the city of Santa Cruz did almost nothing and pretended they were never going to grow. And so now how much should the state of California suffer for the city of Santa Cruz's lack of willingness to plan? And I'm on the side of the university. I think the city is in a very weak position and should become more proactive.
Well,
I'm not anti-university. I think that it's a tremendous asset that's terribly underutilized.
Can I ask a question about...
But we only want the good things.
Hey, Mike, do you have a problem? Can you hear Mike in Santa Cruz? Can you hear Mike Rotkin? He's been talking to you.
No, I haven't heard a thing.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
I can't hear him.
Isn't that strange? Okay, well, I'm going to... This is the oddest thing. I'll go ahead and relay. Mike...
So my question was...
He wants to know...
And it's quite honest question, you know.
He wants to know the question.
Would he have been in favor of one of these three solutions? Because I don't know what else there would be.
You know what I'm going to do? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put him on hold, and he'll be able to hear you. Go ahead.
So my question would be, which of three options makes some sense to you, which is take a row of houses out on Bay Street to have a wider street there, or take a row of houses out on High Street to have more... traffic capacity there, or an Eastern Access, which ends up dumping cars into the same Highway 19 intersection and therefore backing up the traffic that's currently on High Street and Bay. I don't think any of those three car solutions, or if you have another one, I'm quite honestly open to hearing it. I don't think there is a solution. So even if the city had planned earlier and done everything we should do, it would have been one of those kinds of solutions, taking out a lot of housing for widening streets. Should we have done that? Would that have been a better plan?
Okay, Mike, I'm sure you heard Mike that time.
I think, yeah, I did hear him. And I think that those would have been better solutions in the long run. There was space available to make up for the housing that would have been taken out. But it's like the university stated how big they wanted to become. And the city said, okay, here's what we can do. And then they didn't do any of it.
Well,
and to that extent, but that's sort of typical of the liberal mindset that came in the 70s, and it started with Gary Patton. And now you're in a situation where you don't have sales tax revenue. And you created it. And now you have to fix it.
I think the problem...
Can you hear him now?
Yes.
The problem, when the university first came, they were planning to be 27,500 students. That was the initial plan. And that was 1960-62 period when they developed that plan. This was before there was, you know, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, for example, was published in 1962. People had not thought about the environment. There was no such phrase as environmentalist, for example, doesn't exist if you go back and look in media. Nobody had thought that there are any growth limits that were possible or needed. You could always build anything anywhere and just make it bigger was better. And under those conditions, nobody had really thought, well, what is the impact of a 27,500 student campus on a little town like Santa Cruz, which was then 35,000 student, 35,000 population, now about 58,000. And nobody had thought, well, gee, if we bring a big university and we plant 27,000 students here, there are going to be water problems and there's going to be sewer issues and water capacity questions, and there may not be, we have to build a lot of housing so and various kinds of things. And all of a sudden, we started in the 1960s to discover that there might be some limits to growth, that the growth is not always a good thing, that maybe the quality of towns can be literally destroyed by urban sprawl. And so I think we've learned a lot since everybody back then might have thought, why not have a huge campus with lots of students? That'll be wonderful. And now I think a lot of people, and again, it's not liberal or conservative, a lot of people in this town are very concerned that even 15,000 students is large currently, but certainly 20,000 students, much less 27,000, is going to have a huge impact on the quality of our life. So I don't think people share your sense that we can absorb 27,500 students, the initial plan, or even the 20,000 the campus is currently thinking about in some easy way. And again, you did answer my question. Your view would be take out a row of houses perhaps on one of those streets. Let me tell you, don't run for public office because you're dead on arrival. If that's, you'll never sell that to the neighborhoods in the city of Santa Cruz.
Well, I agree with that part of it, because what's happened in Santa Cruz is that you've said no so many times. I don't mean just you.
I understand.
I mean, the city of Santa Cruz has just said no. That's all the citizens know is no. And it's not in my backyard. It's like when they tried to relocate the transit center or put in Home Depot over on the west side.
I had made that point earlier. I agree with you on that point, that our whole focus on stopping this incredible growth pressure trained us to be able, very, very good at saying no to everything and not particularly good at saying yes to stuff. And I share that view. And at this point, I think we have to try and decide what kind of growth makes sense. And I said this as well. I'm not against the university growing to 19,500 students possibly, but I do think they have to take seriously addressing how can that growth impact be dealt with. You can't just ignore it or say it'll fix itself, because it won't fix itself.
Well, there's no question it won't fix itself. But one thing that has been proven is through all the efforts to stop growth, is it happened anyway. And you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, and I don't claim to be an expert. But what we've ended up with now from just saying no to everything hasn't worked. And there has to be some new roads, there has to be some widening, and there has to be more emphasis on mass transit. I'm for all those things. But but to pretend that the growth isn't going to happen, the infilling that has taken place in Santa Cruz is mind-boggling. I grew up here. I've seen all the little lots that have now turned into condos, and that is, we have to have that. But we have the same roads we've had for 40 years.
Mike, we got to move on to our next caller. Thanks for calling. Here's Jan in San Lorenzo Valley. You're on, Jan.
Hi, thanks. Hi, Mike. I was just... Actually, before I get into my other part, I had a picture kind of emerge in my head as you people were talking about different modes of transportation up there, and I could just see all these kids with jetpacks on their backs flying around, bumping into each other. And, you know.
That's a funny picture.
Yeah. But, Mike, for a long time I've heard that you were the one who up at the university wrote a paper on how to take over a small town.
My doctoral dissertation.
Uh-huh.
Is a history of the progressive movement in Santa Cruz from basically looked at the period from about 1970 until I was elected mayor in 1981-82. And it certainly was not my description how to take over a small town. What I talked about was how the movement in Santa Cruz got built that actually, you know, created environmental movement for environmental protection and for increased social services and things like that. So it was not quite the conspiracy theory that some of the local letters to the editor suggested, but that's what that claim is based on, though.
Oh, darn, I wanted to ask you what the next step, according to your paper, and where we're at now would be.
Well, I had argued for kind of in that paper, the idea of empowering local communities to have more control over what their impacts are on them, and that that it is important for citizens to be involved in the planning process, which I still support. I do think the previous caller to you, was making a point that we have reached a point where often we're just sort of on a knee-jerk basis oppose any kind of development, no matter what it is, for any purpose. And I think I certainly have learned more than I knew when I started, and even certainly then when I wrote that dissertation, about trying to figure out how do you have reasonable growth that's planned and organized.
Yeah, it's almost like you have to plan the infrastructure anyway, because even if you keep it small, it's going to grow a certain percentage.
I think that's the case. It certainly has not grown as fast as they were intending for it to grow, but it's not that we've had no growth impacts. Everybody understands. Part of the problem is literally how many cars there are compared to the number of people. We have that ratio goes up all the time, and if we could have a decent public transportation system. And we have a pretty good one for a small town, but it needs to be a lot better.
Yeah.
We find a way to get people out of their cars, because right now, when you turn 16, it's like you don't exist if you don't have a car and you don't drive it everywhere that you need to go. And
we have to change that kind of mindset. There are two cars for every one person.
Wow.
Well, in California, it's about 1.6 per person. Cars to people. Well, there's more cars than people in California, which is a scary thought.
Well, they can't all drive them at the same time, though, right?
That's the one good thing, probably, yeah.
Well, my opinion of this whole thing is I think we should keep the university at a certain number, because anything above that's going to create, mass congestion and zillions of problems. Why can't they build another university, somewhere else, not that far away, maybe access to a freeway or something, so that...
Maybe an app toss.
Well, they're actually talking about that they might expand the Ames Center over in the Santa Clara Valley, or that they might think about a new campus, an 11th campus somewhere in the Santa Clara Valley might be a possibility.
I think that would be smart. And I'm hopefully Blumenthal really will work with the community.
We have another caller. Thank you, Jan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Steve in Felton. Steve in Watsonville. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, Councilman Rotkin.
Yes.
Hi. I was listening to the show and discussing the lawsuits. I think you might have acknowledged a little bit that the state is sort of in a driver's seat. So with the CEQA protests and stuff like that, it really comes down to what they want to do. Am I correct so far?
Well, they are confronted by not the city council, which doesn't have power over them, but by state law that requires them to follow certain procedures in at least exposing what the impacts of their planned growth are. And that's the one place where we felt, and the court, we were proved correct in court, that we do have a right to ask that they let us know what they're up to, they look at the impacts, and come up with at least some plan for how they're going to address those impacts.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we don't have, they're in the driver's seat to the extent to which we can't tell them how to solve those problems or make them do what we think makes the most sense.
Yeah, my one concern with that is if it just boils down to basically kind of harassing or delaying tactics, I can only see that increasing the cost to the taxpayers for whatever project is eventually done. And that kind of relates to the lawsuit they proposed pursuing against the state with a pheromone spraying after Monterey County has already had theirs thrown out. I just don't see the point in it. And if I can do a little sidetrack, I believe you were absent from the meeting that made that vote.
The one last Tuesday, yes, I was.
Yeah, I was wondering if you'd want to give your opinion on that, on that lawsuit, for, against, or indifferent. But also, I'll have one more question. I'll take the answer off the air. I was wondering if there's any way a person can find out how much is budgeted or how much is spent by the city of Santa Cruz on these lawsuits, which sometimes seem like they're little more than symbolism.
Yeah, it's all public information. And if you, I'm the only Rotkin in the phone book. If you call me and give me your phone number or email, I'll be happy to get back to you with those numbers for at least the last year. But those are available to the public in the public library as well.
Okay, very good. I'll have emailed you before I will again. And like I said, off the air, if you'd care to give your opinion on the plan of the city of Santa Cruz to sue the state for the pheromone spraying.
Sure. A quick answer to that. My view is that, and I said this to the crowd 2 weeks earlier when this issue was before us at that time, I'm not somebody who is absolutely opposed ever to any kind of spraying or whatever, even though I know that there are people that share that do hold that view. I could be persuaded that for a true emergency, that it might make sense to spray even over the public areas and urban areas to control some pests that were at risk for destroying, for example, the apple crop and Santa Cruz County is a big economic issue for us. But I think the public has a right to know a lot of information about what it is that's being sprayed over their houses and over their where their kids are outside playing and stuff. And so the city suit is not, from my point of view, now different council members may have different views here, is not so much that you know they should never spray under any conditions, but they basically proposed initially to spray over these urban areas where people live, and we're talking about 6 days a month until two life cycles of the moth passed, the final moth is found. In other words, when they keep destroying, trying to kill these moths by having them not be able to mate, which is what the pheromones thing's about, that after the last, they keep looking for moths. When they no longer find a moth, we're going to keep spraying for like two more life cycles of the moth, which is another year. So we're talking about probably spraying for the rest of our natural lives, 6 days a month over the Santa Cruz. This is not a plan that's going to like end after two sprayings or four sprayings. So what the city... And the reality, and the state's doing this, not they've done no environmental review of this plan. They declared it, there was an emergency, and they exempt themselves from the California Environmental Quality Act because it's an emergency. They don't have to do review. They say, we got to deal with this quickly. We don't have time for review. And if I thought it was going to be, you know, no time for review, do one spraying and move on, I would not be in favor of a suit. We only have 35 days from the announcement of what they plan to do, which means we only have until, at this point, something like November 3rd or 4th to either sue them over this declaration of an emergency that requires no environmental review, or we'll never, ever be able to ask that they do an environmental review of this entire process that they're planning to dump on us. Now, initially, they wouldn't even tell us what was in the spray. They said it was proprietary information, that we don't have to tell you what's in there because some company is going to be doing it. You know, I'm sorry, but if you're going to spray me and persuade me as a public official that I'm going to say it's okay to spray the people in my town, you better tell us what's in the spray. Answer every question anybody has. They should have gone through an environmental review for this, taken an extra couple of weeks, and actually, I'm not talking about a year-long process, spend some more time letting everybody know what's in the spray, what's their exact plan, how many years are they going to be spraying this, what is their expectation of the problems that it's going to lead to, and so forth. And at that point, I would not be arguing for suing the state. I'd say, okay, here's the information. Let's look at it. Let's make some hard decisions about what's reasonable. The public simply doesn't have the information that they deserve to have about what this plan is, how long we're going to be stuck with it, and what its likelihood of success is. With that information, I might be willing to rely more on experts to let other people tell us this is the way it ought to happen or something else. But I think I share at least the majority of my colleagues' view on the council that we should not allow the spraying to go forward on the basis of, and I'm quoting the state agricultural official, trust me. That's not the basis for spraying the city of Santa Cruz for the next several decades.
Okay. Hey, thanks very much for your actually, we do have one more call. Is this John in Felton again, or is there another John in Felton?
Nope, same John.
Okay, enough, John. Sorry, this is ridiculous. You know, we're not going to monopolize it with the same person. Thanks, but no thanks. Sorry, don't mean to be mean to anybody, but we don't want to hear from the same caller twice during the program. This is not a program for them. It's a program for other callers. 479-1080 if you want to be one of those other callers. And we've got about 13 minutes left in the program. And let's do the commercial break now for this hour. And stay with us, gang. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Hey, it's MZ. I want to share one of my very private emails with you. It's from the famous Andy of Kitchen Express in response to my request for him to email me bullet points for his new ad. Hey, MZ, here are the bullet points. Celebrating our 10th anniversary and have become Santa Cruz's oldest continuously owned kitchen and bath showroom, recently voted Santa Cruz County's number one kitchen and bath showroom by my son. Featuring 12 lines of custom and modular cabinets for all areas of the house, for all budgets, with over 20 years of experience and expert computer kitchen design and consultation. We know our stuff. Countertop headquarters for Corian, Silestone, Caesar Stone, and Zodiacqua quartz counters. Nobody does it better or quicker. Decorative plumbing fixtures for kitchen and bath. Come see our working shower demonstration featuring multiple shower heads and working steam shower. Come and take a shower. Extensive selection of cabinet hardware. Up to 60% off every day. Thanks, MZ. Andy. Kitchen Express is located on the Frontage Road just off of Highway 1 at Rio Del Mar. Exit 6.
562-3700.
This is Bill Lambert of Lambert & Son Moving, your local family-owned and operated mover, serving the entire Monterey Bay region for local moves and relocations throughout the state of California. Call Bill Lambert at 420-0419 for a free, no-obligation estimate. Moving advice is always free, no job too small or too large. Our staff at Lambert & Son Moving is really exceptional. Our crews are trained movers who are careful, polite, courteous, and trustworthy. We never hire temporary labor, only trained, skilled, professional movers. Lambert & Son Moving also offers local delivery from the Santa Cruz Costco. We have delivered a lot of big-screen TVs, refrigerators, washers and dryers, and sectional sofas from Costco. Give Bill a call for details at 420-0419. Let our family take care of your family's move. 420-0419. Or go online at www.lambertmoving.com.
It is the grand opening of Santa Cruz Tile and Stone, located at 1800 Soquel Drive, number 2 in Santa Cruz. Come in today for the grand opening specials. You'll find full and prefabricated slabs in granite, marble, limestone, and travertine at great prices. Are you planning a remodel or new kitchen, entryway, or bathroom? Then you need to let Santa Cruz Tile and Stone have the opportunity to meet your needs. Listen to these prices. Slate at $250 per square foot. Ceramic tile with completed trim for only $1.15 per square foot. At Santa Cruz Tile and Stone, you'll find one of the largest display and showrooms for tile and stone in the area. Santa Cruz Tile and Stone is open Monday through Friday from 7:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., Saturday 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and on Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And don't forget to bring the kids, as you'll find a playroom to occupy them while you shop. Santa Cruz Tile and Stone, conveniently located at 1800 Soquel Drive, Unit Number 2 in Santa Cruz. Phone 421-0292. That's 421-0292.
Okay, it's MZ with an alert for those of you who might be interested in a new residual income business opportunity. I've said it before and I'll keep saying it until it sinks in. If people only knew what they were missing by not having a residual income, they wouldn't miss it. Imagine being in charge of your own life, setting your own schedule, being able to legitimately charge things like travel, food, entertainment, communications, and equipment to your own business. Once you get a taste of this, you'll wish you had known about residual income sooner. But don't worry, it's never too late. Trouble is, most people have no idea about how to get started in their own residual income business. But I have the perfect solution for you. Log on to www.money.kseo.com and download the 21-minute presentation that Dave Allen edited from a recent Saturday special. Listen to it, and if you're interested, shoot me an email, mz@kseo.com, and I'll put you into our system so that you can get started. Get in on the ground floor of something I believe will be very big very soon. Remember, go to money.kseo.com and listen to a very good future for yourself if you choose it. Money.kseo.com.
Okay, we're back with the about 8 minutes remaining in hour number 2 of the Saturday special. Here's Steve Hartman in Montana, of all places. Steve, you're on.
I just wanted that conservative city council member sitting at your table to know that I've got my eye on him.
Oh, we have to put him.
Hi, Steve.
Are you really in Montana?
Yeah, he lives there now. He got so disgusted with Santa Cruz that he left.
It's such a joy to be laughing from the outside than living in crisis on the inside. I must tell you, but I've got a great idea for you. I think you ought to take Ocean Street and give it to the state so that it can be an extension of Highway 17. And you can get extra money to have them plow the road right to the beach.
There you go.
We are currently doing a study of Ocean Street, Steve, if you're not current on what's going on in Santa Cruz. But
I'm very current.
Okay.
My property's on Cayuga Street. I've been waiting for you to redevelop after turning my neighborhood topsy-turvy about 5 years ago. With the traffic redirection plan, I've been waiting for you to put the promenade on Cayuga so I could sell out. I'm not going to sell out before you do that.
Just so the public knows, Steve is a generous guy who actually created a public water fountain on his own private property there. It's always great
for
to walk
Catherine,
by
it. I did it for Catherine Byers because she needed a place to run in the morning, and she was always thirsty.
That was very generous of you.
Yeah, see, I got beach. I got bench of the county this year. In the good times.
Steve, just one question. Is it snowing yet?
No. It's about 50 degrees. There's there's elk hunters running all over the neighborhood, packing their guns.
Keep your head down.
Will you send me some elk jerky, Stevie?
Actually, I got to tell you, there's a great deal on jerky at Costco right now. $4.50 off on 18 ounces. It's delicious. But I'll see if I can't find you some elk jerky.
It's not here. Oh, good. Okay, this is great. Hey, thanks for calling.
Now, wait just a minute. There's one more thing. I think one of the big problems, one of the big progressive mistakes was rebuilding the Riverside Bridge after the flood instead of going ahead and putting in an Ocean Street Bridge. I think not only would it ease traffic concerns on the east side, but it would also reduce the drug problem in the Beach Flats area, having direct access to the beach without going through the neighborhood. I'm wondering, is anybody ever going to look at an Ocean Street Bridge now that CHC's plans are dead?
Well, you know, the Ocean Street Bridge got killed because basically the feds, after the earthquake, were not willing to pay for the replacement of a bridge in a different location. They would only pay us to rebuild it where it was. And the city actually tried to our first choice was to build an Ocean Street Bridge once the River Street Bridge went down, but we were simply unsuccessful at persuading them, and we didn't have the kind of millions of dollars. I mean, we're talking here, like, you know, I don't know what a bridge costs, but $50 million, $70 million. We didn't have that kind of money locally to pay for the bridge ourselves. So you and I don't actually agree on that one. It would have been much better to have had the Ocean Street Bridge than the current structure of wandering through the Lower East, Lower Ocean neighborhood, and then eventually across into the beach neighborhood.
Isn't
but we simply couldn't pull it off.
How about 9/11 money or something like that? Because it seems to me that terrorism could be pointed to in the Beach Flats area just for the drug trade alone.
Things aren't as bad as they used to be, Steve.
But and clearly, Ocean Street Bridge, $70 million today, probably would have been $10 to $20 million when it happened.
Okay, Steve,
anyway,
thank you so much for calling. We only have 5 minutes, 4 minutes left, and we want to hear from Brian in King City, and we have some other callers. We want
anyway,
to talk with
Seal,
too. Thank you, Steve. Here's Brian in King City. You're on, Brian.
Oh, thanks very much for giving me the opportunity.
Sure.
I guess, am laughing from the outside now that I can afford a home in South Monterey as opposed to North or Santa Cruz County. My question is from a couple of callers ago. I guess it was sort of a half-hearted joke, but, well, we just don't have UC Santa Cruz grow anymore, and they can go to another UC campus. That campus was already created some years ago after quite a bit of effort. It's called UC Merced.
Right.
Don't expect UC campus within our lifetime. UC Santa Cruz was designed for a purpose. Everybody knows how many students they have now, how many they're capable of growing, and that's what's going to be. I'm hearing the same repetition again. Well, we'll just say no, and they'll have to deal with it. And again, if it's, what, 15,000, 17,000 students now, it'll easily go to another 3,000 students within the next 10 years, easily. And what you're jostling around more infrastructural positions on, well, what if you don't do this? What if you don't do that? You know, part of the problem, yes, it's not the city of Santa Cruz's fault. I grant you that. But Ben Lohman, Aptos, all the surrounding communities have helped contribute to the problem. And, yes, Santa Cruz alone cannot solve it. It's akin to what's going on right now in my wife's town of Honolulu. They're trying now, after the fact, to try and implement a light rail, which is sheer folly given the current infrastructure. And that, in a smaller scale, is what Santa Cruz has. Hard choices are going to have to be made. You're going to have to plow up the main street like it did down in Los Angeles under Wilshire and build a light rail if you ever want to solve this problem. You're going to have to step on somebody's toes. Change will have to happen, and it's not going to be pleasant.
Let me just say that, you know, in terms of light rail, I mean, that would be a great solution in the abstract, but it's just far too expensive for a town of 55,000 people. Even if the campus doubled in size, we wouldn't have the riding population to support light rail or a subway system or some, you know, subway system or those kinds of things. So it's, again, I take your main point. And the city council has not taken the position the university should not grow. That is not the city council's position. Our position has been if they're going to grow, they have to grow in a responsible way, and that requires planning. But unfortunately, light rail won't be the solution. I do think some kind of public transit expansion is our solution, and question of, you know, making sure the university pays its fair share of the cost of that expansion. And it's not just more buses. They're stuck in the same traffic as everybody else. We either need something like a bus rapid transit that gives buses priorities at intersections or some kind of a people mover that allows people to get from downtown up to the campus without going through the intersections of that are currently impacted. And again, it's not like you can easily absorb 3,000 people. I do ask listeners to imagine what will happen at Bay and Mission. Let me do the math very quickly. If you invite additional 4,500 students, which is the university's current attempt for growth, and add 1,800 faculty and staff, which is the number they project would be necessary to serve those additional students. Of the 1,800 faculty and staff, currently 90% of faculty and staff ride their individual cars. So let's just be conservative. 1,000 more cars on the road from the faculty and staff, and then 50% of the new students, which is about, you know, roughly 2,200 more students. I think it's not unreasonable to expect that there'd be 3,000 more cars at the Bay Mission intersection. How are you going to absorb that? Anybody that's been near the Bay and Mission intersection at 5 o'clock knows that that's just absurd and not possible. So there needs to be some planning, and you can't just say it'll take care of itself. And so it's not a matter of it just working out. We have to have the university take this as a serious issue, and they just haven't done it to this
point. Sorry, Irwin and Oakland, Big Gun Gordy and Gary and Greenfield. There's no time for you guys. And sorry, and no time for you either, Seal. Mike, you took off all the time, but it was always delightful.
I'm sorry.
And it's the end of the radio program, so we got to do it again. In fact, we got to do it on a regular basis or something. But, yeah, there's a lot to talk about. We should be using the radio station and the university as the great resources that they are. Thanks for being here, guys.
After 6 days, wildfires in three Southern California counties still threatening about 23,000 homes. Fox's Chris Gutierrez.
There are five fires right now that are burning, of which they're somewhere between the realm of 35% contained. Some are actually 100% contained, but they're still burning.
No water, no power, pollution, just some of the residual effects of the Southern California wildfires.
Even if you don't see it, you can smell and even taste the smoke in the air. It's bad enough to inspire a warning to keep kids inside and for those with lung and heart problems to stay indoors as well. And area hospitals are seeing more people walk in complaining of breathing problems.
Fox Radio's Rich Johnson in San Diego. The wildfires, the focus of the president's weekly radio address.
I made a pledge to the people of California on behalf of all Americans. We will help you put out the fires, get through the crisis, and rebuild your lives.
1,800 homes in Southern California gone, 500,000 acres scorched. S-CHIP, again the subject of the Democrats' radio response this week.
It is time for Republicans to join the Democrats in overriding President Bush's veto and to reauthorize this program. 81% of the American people and governors of both parties from states all across the country support our effort to cover these 10 million uninsured children.
Democratic National Committee Chair Howard Dean, two contracts down, one to go.
Calling it a historic four-year contract, the United Auto Workers Union announced that its members have passed a new deal with Chrysler. This despite significant opposition by some local union members.
Fox Radio's Rod Fritz, with Chrysler and GM contracts completed, job one for UAW negotiators, an agreement with Ford. Lots of work underway for the space shuttle astronauts.
Re-enabling the smoke detectors in Node 1.
Opening a new room on the International Space Station. They're calling that room Harmony. And you're listening to Fox News Radio, Fair and Balanced.
Fox News Talk salutes our listeners in the Cornhusker state of Nebraska. Listening to Fox News Talk, and stay tuned as we continue our salute to the 50 states of freedom.
The White House not happy about the release of Jamal al-Badawi, one of the terrorists responsible for the bombing of the USS Cole when it was docked in Yemen in the year 2000.
According to a spokesman for the National Security Council, his release is inconsistent with ongoing anti-terrorism efforts between the U.S. and Yemen. The Justice Department has communicated its displeasure to the Yemeni government, and Washington says it will work to make sure the al-Qaeda mastermind is held accountable for his past terrorist actions.
Fox's Julie Kurtz. Turkey's prime minister back and forth over military action against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq. Fox's Carolyn Shively.
Turkey has moved 100,000 of its troops to the border, and they're all pointed toward Iraq. Last night, Turkey rejected an Iraqi plan to take on the PKK, saying it was too weak. The rebels have killed about 40 people in Turkey over the last month. The two sides have actually been fighting since 1984 because the Kurds want to carve out an ethnic homeland in the southeastern part of Turkey.
Yesterday, Turkey's prime minister had said he would wait until his meeting with President Bush next week before deciding on sending troops to Iraq. New surveillance photos show what the U.S. military believes is an Iranian-made rocket. It's aimed at a U.S. airbase south of Baghdad. The Pentagon calling it another indication of Iran's involvement in the insurgency. Can the Rocks come back against the Sox? Fox's Dave Anthony.
Hoping the thin air cures their hitting that's worn thin, the Colorado Rockies return home, hosting Game 3 of a World Series that's been dominated so far by Red Sox pitching. The Rockies scoring just two runs in the first two games in Boston. To break out of their slump, Colorado hopes to rock Daisuke Matsuzaka, Boston's $100 million Japanese pitcher. Colorado counters with Josh Fogg.
Game time, 8:35 p.m. Eastern on Fox. I'm Jane Metzler, Fox News Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. You have it tuned in to AM 1080 KSCO Santa Cruz. It's Saturday, October 27th, 2007. Today's forecast calls for partly cloudy conditions with highs around 71 degrees. Wind should be south-southwest, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight you can expect partly cloudy conditions with lows around 50 degrees. And it looks like tomorrow we'll start off partly cloudy, giving way to mainly sunny skies in the afternoon. And highs around 75 degrees tomorrow night, partly cloudy with lows around 51 degrees. Today's Monterey Bay Boaters forecast, light southeast winds becoming west, 5 to 10 knots in the afternoon with wind waves 1 foot or less, and a northwest swell 2 to 4 feet at 9 seconds. Outside the studios, it is 59 degrees, the time 12:05, and it's time for the Perspective Show right here on AM 1080, KSCO Santa Cruz.
Good afternoon. You've tuned in to the Perspectives Radio Show. My name is Donald Davidson. I'll be your co-host. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. David Biles, our local doctor of dentistry, and our very special guest, Ed McCabe, also known as Mr. Oxygen. Dr. Biles, would you like to introduce our guest?
I'd love to. Thank you, Donald. Before I introduce our guest, Mr. Oxygen, I want to credit Kim Tunnell, our producer, for